That sound might not mean a lot to you, but if you're a kid trying to figure out what's in a wrapped present, it's unmistakable. Legos. And it's a sound that surrounds Joe Nunnick every day at work. The master model builder at Legoland in Crown Center works in a narrow room lined with about 10,000 different shapes and colors of Legos, even colors you've never heard of.
The Lego company calls it nougat.
Lining the walls are Lego renditions of everything from the Incredible Hulk to little golden trophies. And there's a window for spectators to watch Joe at work.
This is a big project I'm working on right now, which is a model of Children's Mercy Hospital.
The miniature Children's Mercy, about 2 by 2 feet wide, is just partly built. Joe has propped up a drawing he made of the building behind his work table.
It would make a lot more sense for this pillar to be like one unit over, because then it would line up with these bricks right here and these ones. This is all glued, so I was planning on just ripping this off and moving it.
Joe does this for a living. It's the kind of workday most people stop even imagining at around, probably age 6. But Joe is living proof that gainful employment as a Lego master can be reality. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking to three local people who have the kinds of jobs that make the rest of adult society incredibly jealous. Whether the daily grind of those jobs is as dreamy as we think is another matter to be determined over the course of this hour. Let's start back with Joe Nunnick. He's the Lego master we stopped in on before. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, later in the hour, we'll be hearing from Chuck Haddix, who's turned his passion for record collecting into a profession, playing music for several thousand friends every Friday and Saturday night, as well as Daniel Loreen. He's a location scout, meaning he travels all over the place to find scenic spots, you know, for filming scenes, because you got to get that palm tree to sand ratio just right. So, Joe, I'm guessing you played with Legos as a kid?
Yeah, I did all the time. My mom and my grandma were always getting me Lego sets. It's like all I wanted. I knew someone had to be making and designing the Lego out there. I didn't know who. Didn't think that was a realistic goal, but it's definitely was a dream job, and I kind of stumbled into my dream job. So,
well, even back, like when you talk about liking Legos, that is a description of so many kids out there. And
right.
I'm wondering if your relationship with Lego building was different from other kids who like Legos a lot, or were you the typical Lego enthusiast? I mean, to what extent did this go?
I think at a certain point, like when I was young, it probably seemed like any typical kid playing with Lego. But I think at a certain extent, I think it was pretty obvious to, like, you know, my family and stuff that I was pretty into it. I think I kind of developed, like, as an artist early on with Lego bricks. And because I remember, like, building this castle when I was, like, 9 or 10. And it was like pretty well designed, you know, had some like aesthetic qualities to it. And
how big was it?
I worked on it like on and off for like several months. So it just kept getting bigger as time went on. But it ended up being like 3 feet tall. It was just out of control. I had no other Legos to play with. They were all dedicated to the castle. So
did anyone in your family or like any teachers in your life, I don't know, did anyone ever try to get you to branch out and not focus so intently on Legos?
Well, I mean, I wasn't like I wasn't like crazy with Lego, you know. I didn't really like bring them to school or anything. It's not like all I talked about or anything. I had like a lot of other interests, you know. For example, I was very interested in Pokemon cards, so, you know, I'm a very diverse person, you know,
actually. At what point did you become even aware that there was such a thing as a master model builder for Legolands?
I don't know. Like, I think I'm starting to think, like, when I was a kid, I don't really know if that kind of buzzword or that, like, that job title was really in my, you know, in my brain. I don't know if I'd really heard that. I know it's been popularized, like, with the Lego movie. And obviously Kansas City has a Legoland Discovery Center now, which was not here when I was a kid. So, you know, as
and
far
you grew
as,
up here.
Yeah, I grew up in Kansas City, and it was just Florida then that had like a Legoland in California, I think. So
in the meantime, like when this wasn't a job that you necessarily knew of, and when you knew that someone had to make Legos, design Legos and all that stuff, but as you were saying before, it seemed like kind of this remote, not real possibility. What were you pursuing?
Oh, I mean, as I got older, I went to college. I went to the Kansas City Art Institute, and I studied animation. So I definitely decided at some point that I wanted to be an artist. I wasn't sure of it right when I graduated high school. In fact, I went to a liberal arts school and thought maybe I'd study history or English or something. But I ended up transferring to the Art Institute and had a lot of fun making animations. So definitely always been a creative. I have to have my hands on something, you know, making something. But never did I think, you know, until a few months ago that I would be working with Lego brick every day. So it's been a dream come true. Yeah.
When you were studying history or studying animation, do you think that those things helped you become who and what you are today? I mean, I think it's interesting looking back at my own education and career, how much preparation for my current role came from things that I would have considered totally unrelated. And I think most people still would look at from the outside and be like, no relationship between those things.
Yeah, definitely. I think when I studied animation, I think part of like the animation process is just being super patient and realizing that you're kind of chipping away at kind of like a giant block of marble per se. And then in the end, it's a great payoff, but it definitely is something that takes a lot of patience. And I think that, and also just knowing how to get through a project and the art making process of like pre-production, production, post-production. I think all of that helps me like every single day in my job. And I think
how does it help you? How does that translate to what you do right now? Like, can you explain that?
Yeah. So, for instance, right now I'm working on a model of Children's Mercy. I think I'd mentioned it in that audio clip. But for the last like 3 or 4 weeks, I've kind of been in a pre-production phase. So I haven't been actually building it until just like last week. I was, you know, doing drawings. Like I drove around the hospital a few times, like looking, took a bunch of pictures. I made a floor plan. I did all this stuff, ordered the necessary brick from the Lego company that I needed. And
I like
finally,
that you say brick singular, like hair products. People say product. You say Lego brick.
Yeah. Actually, the word Lego is plural. So I found this out just by working at Legoland. But they'll teach you to say Lego brick and not Legos. So it's a hard adjustment.
While you were pursuing your sort of, I wouldn't say typical, but while you were pursuing your education in a way that all kinds of people who aren't going to become Lego model builders do, did you keep up your skills Lego-wise? I mean, were you a college student playing with Legos on the side?
No, not at all. Nope. But I, when I saw like the job opening and stuff, you know, I remembered I was pretty good at one point, you know, years ago. And I think if you're, as long as you're doing something creative or you're making something, it's not too hard to, you know, transition back to something you used to do creatively. You know,
using those skills.
Yeah. It's when you stop doing things altogether that I think you really slow down, but I don't know.
Tell me about seeing the job listing. I mean, what did your brain do?
I think I was working at a bank at the time as a teller, and I was looking for other jobs online. I was looking for creative work, and I saw that they were hiring a master builder, and I kind of applied just as a joke. You know, it's just like, I gotta apply for this. Like, I think I told my friends, like, yeah, I applied to be a master builder at Legoland, and we had a laugh about it. Like, no one thought that I would actually get this job. I didn't. I figured there was somebody out there who was, you know, some kind of Lego shark who's gonna just destroy me in the interview process. But yeah,
that didn't happen.
I guess not. No.
What was the interview process?
It was pretty crazy. Pretty non-typical interview process. It was a 2-day competition involving like 3 rounds of building and a one-on-one interview with the managers there. Yeah.
What did you have to build as part of your like audition?
So the first round, they gave us a theme, and we had 30 minutes to build, and there was about 30 people there. And the theme of the first round was the spirit of Kansas City. And so I really didn't know what I was going to make till kind of the last minute. I was debating between like some kind of fountain and, I was thinking about the Western Auto sign. And then when I saw the brick that we had to choose from, which is very standard, like basic blocks, essentially, I went with the Western Auto sign just on a gut impulse.
Really? Because I would have thought that the standard brick would hit the, you know, Legos. I'm sorry, I'm not professional,
no.
So I'm going
to
say
no, that's, I have to say Lego brick. You can call it Legos.
If you see them, they're, you know, rectangles and squares, and the Western Auto sign is rounded. And, I mean, I was not Lego-like sophisticated as a child, but I do remember rounding things. You'd have those kind of stair-step things, which I imagine a professional like yourself has some better technique. But I would think that the roundedness of that shape, the Western Auto sign, would have been like, no.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I didn't actually like make the like complete sign. I basically spelled Western Auto and kind of hope for the best. So, because we had 30 minutes, and I would have loved to have made the entire sign rounded off like that. But as I started to look around the room, I could tell that some people just did it to have fun. I mean, there were some just like piles of brick and stuff. So I started to feel better about it. There was 2 more rounds after that too. The second round was Under the Sea or Sea Life. And so I kind of, and they told us the theme like 10 minutes before that time. So we kind of had to make up our mind really quick. And I decided to build a whale washing up on shore.
That also sounds really hard to me. But Joe Nunick, tell me, do you remember finding out that you got the job as master builder for Legoland?
I do. It was a pretty surreal moment. I want to tell a funny story, and I hope my marketing, the marketing manager is listening, because they always throw him under the bus for this. It's really funny. But so there was 2 guys named Joe in the final round, me and another fellow, and they didn't think to mention the last name when they announced the winner, so they said the winner is Joe. And it was really anticlimactic because everyone froze, no one moved, and I just locked eyes with the other guy named Joe, and he was locking eyes with me. And there is like a whole minute of just like complete apprehension. And finally, they figured out the last name, and then they said, Joe in. I was like, oh my goodness, that was the most painstaking minute of my life. But yeah, after that, it was completely, it was just overwhelming. Like, very strange moment.
Tell me about your first day at work in your new job as master Lego builder for Legoland. I mean, how do you get started at something like that?
Right.
How do feel really like this is really my job now?
Well, that feeling took like several weeks to come to. Like, I'm still kind of coming to it. Like, this is actually my job. I think my first day, my boss brought me into my workshop, which is this like crazy little labyrinth filled with Lego brick on all over the walls. And he said, you know, try to focus on Halloween because Halloween's coming up. And then I think he had to go do something else. So I think for a few hours I was left there and I just like started making a pumpkin. And I was like, wow, this is the greatest job in the world.
Well, hold that thought, because I want to compare notes with some of our other amazing job panelists. Let's talk with Chuck Haddix, the host of the Friday and Saturday Night Fish Fry here on KCUR. He also runs the Mar Sound Archive at UMKC. And Chuck, if someone were to say that you play your favorite records for a living, would you agree, or is that a romanticized interpretation of what you do?
No, I agree. I'm very fortunate. I like to collect records. I like to play records, and I get paid to do both. So I mean, that's a dream job for any record collector or somebody that's into radio.
Tell me the story of your interest in music. I mean, can you pinpoint where it began, or were you just like born that way?
Well, you know, I've always liked radio. And I listened to radio. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. I was born in 1951. And I remember going over to my grandmother's house and putting on WHB on her old setup, you know, her old Victrola setup, and from the 40s. And my brother had a radio out in the garage where he used to work on cars, so I spent a lot of time in a garage listening to radio. And he had a 44 that he was parked in the driveway, and I'd go out and sit out there and pretend I was driving to California and listen to the radio, and I ran the battery down. And so, you know, eventually I discovered, I listened to WHB like most kids of my generation did, and then I discovered on the right end of the AM dial, KPRS, and started listening to James Brown and soul music. And at the same time, most people were listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I was listening to those too. I was also listening to James Brown and all the great gospel and jazz they played. And we didn't have any money, but my sister started babysitting, and she started buying records, and she brought home the first Rolling Stones record. And we had an old Silvertone phonograph, and we listened to that over and over and over again. And then when I got in high school, I started collecting records in earnest, and I would go up to Kmart up at the Antioch Shopping Center and look at their records, and they were like $2.99. And I remember looking at the Muddy Waters record and thinking, this is interesting. And like so many kids of my generation, I was introduced to American music by the first British invasion. You know, the Beatles were playing Arthur Alexander songs. The Stones were playing Willie Dixon. And I kept wondering, who's Willie Dixon? You know, and so that started my interest in collecting records. And once you get the bug, you know, I collected records and books.
A lot of people collect records. A lot of people love listening to records. I mean, how do you think that your relationship with those activities became more than a hobby or an interest that you pursued, even passionately, but totally like on the side? You know what I mean?
Well, when I started working in the record business, I went to work for, I was tending bar at Victoria Station. And all these folks that worked in the record business used to hang out there. They had Warner Brothers headquarters here, Columbia. And they had a one-stop called Friends 2 Music, which was, they were called one-stops because there were a lot of small record stores, particularly on the east side at that time. And they could stop in and make one stop and pick up all the 45s, all the cassettes, and all the LPs that they wanted at a discounted price. So I started doing that. And then I went to work for, I was working in a cave down on 31st Street, and I went to work for House Distributors, which was a distributor for small labels, Rounder, Flying Fish, Wyndham Hill, Fantasy Prestige, Milestone, Concord.
So were you just getting as close to records as you could?
Yeah. I was pursuing my interest, and I was very fortunate to get that entree into the record industry, because that really made, well, for one thing, you get a lot of promos. I became a practicing promosexual.
That's right.
I would walk home every night with armloads of records. You didn't make any money, but boy, you got all the records you could carry.
Which is what you would have spent your money on anyway.
Yeah. And then I went to work for Penny Lane Records when it was out in Warnell, and then, of course, on Broadway. And I became the manager of Penny Lane Records. And that really, I mean, you know, it's 10,000 feet of square feet of records, because they had House Distributors in the basement and Penny Lane upstairs.
Now that was in Westport.
Yeah, it was in Westport. And I began to discover, you know, it's a process of discovery. Discovery all about jazz and folk music and blues and what a really broad array of music is there to explore. We used to go to Winfield and sell records down there, and we had lots of great adventures. And then I went to work. Then I got serious about historic recordings. At that time, I began collecting 78s, and Don Mayberger, the camera guy on Rare Visions and Roadside Revelations, was the editor of the Pitch. We started the Pitch at that time, about 1980. And he lived in Lawrence, and he had a van he called Van Morrison, and he parked it in the back of my house on Charlotte Street. And he would come in and spend that weekend and edit the Pitch and then go back home on the weekends. And so we started collecting 78. A friend of mine gave me a Victrola, and we started collecting 78s, and we started going. I always liked to go juking, what we call juking, go junk shopping over on Prospect and Troost. In those days, you had a lot of junk shops. And we'd go in and we'd look at records, and I was looking for blues. And
why is that where you were looking?
Well, because that's where the records were. You know, the great record collectors all went into neighborhoods, in African-American neighborhoods, and collected there, because I was really interested in blues. We collected Glenn Miller and you know, Benny Goodman's, pretty much Bora Minevich and his Harmonica Rascals. It was a process of discovery, and we didn't really have any guidebooks or anything to work with. So we'd go into this stuff. There was the world's smallest free museum and black cultural center at 20th and Vine was a treasure trove. I bought my first Jay McShann record there. And then I went to the Westport Free Market, and Dolores Hobley was there. And I bought my first Julia Lee record there, and for $3, 78. And I said, "Who's Julia Lee?" And she goes, "You don't know who Julia Lee is?"
Great Kansas City singer.
And so I bought that and really started seriously collecting. In fact, on Charlotte Street, Don had his record collecting there too. And all the walls were covered with records.
Well, Chuck, you know, how did you have any notion while you were doing all of this that it was going to lead to something, or were you doing it purely for its own sake without that idea?
We were making it up as we went along, you know. And I mean, you know, in those days it was a lot different than it is today. Tim Finn had a really nice article recently about the decline of record sales. In those days you had like Garrett's Records at 39th and Prospect, H&H Records down on Troost. And there were a lot of records, and when you were working in the business, you were very close to it. It was a very glamorous kind of thing, like you'd get it free at the Uptown Theater. We co-sponsored shows at the Uptown Theater in cooperation with them, because we distributed the records for these artists that were beginning the tour, like the Nighthawks and other artists like that. So
there was a whole network of people who were pursuing this interest all together. But what's the story of the fish fry? How and when did that come about?
Well, you know, eventually, when Terry and I started our family...
That's your wife, obviously.
Yeah, Terry Macro and I started our family. I was not making that much money working in the record business. I was working for the Music Exchange. And I wanted to make a parallel career move. So I met Les Cook, who's now the business editor for NPR, and he was a reporter for KCYR when we were over on Holmes. And I knew quite a bit about jazz, and I was becoming well-known in the community. And they needed a jazz producer, so Les kind of showed me the ropes, and that didn't work out because Sam Scott, who was a general manager, thought he was undermining his authority. But when the time came and they needed a jazz producer, Ron Jones called me up.
He's the director of community engagement at the station now.
Yeah, we go way back. And this is like October, September 1984. And so I started doing jazz in 84, October. And then the next year, I got kind of tired of doing jazz because it was so restrictive about, you know, there's a lot of different rooms in a house of jazz, but everybody's a jazz expert, you know. And we had people working here at the station that were like, "Oh, you can't play any fusion, you can't do this." So I wanted to do something different. So I decided to put together a show where I could play whatever I wanted to play. And so I did a mixtape for Joyce, who was the program director, and she agreed to let me start doing a program called The Fish Fry.
So you just made a mixtape, said, "Here's what I want to do," and someone heard that and said, "Yeah, do it."
Yeah. It started off with Professor Longhair. And Lindsey Shannon was doing the Kansas City Blues show, but he was doing strictly blues. And I thought, I really want to mix this up. I want to include soul, R&B, Zydeco, and just whatever, you know, whatever fits together. And so I started doing the fish fry.
A lot of people would not have the you-know-whats to just say, "I want a show where I play whatever I want, and I'm going to, like, tell someone about that." You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I was very fortunate. You know, so I started doing the fish fry at midnight on Saturday nights. And then eventually I started doing it on Saturday nights earlier. And then I was still doing jazz during the week. And then Ron and Patty Cahill came to me and they said, "Hey, you know, the fish fry's really taken off. Why don't you do it Friday and Saturday nights?" So I started doing from 8 to midnight on Friday and Saturday nights. And fortunately, because I'd worked in the record business and had amassed a collection, I was able to work for my personal collection because they didn't have a collection at that time here at the station.
Describe what it's like to get ready for a show, to put a set list together.
Well, usually I program Friday nights on Wednesday night. That way I can have Thursday night as a kind of a night off. And I go downstairs and I start playing records and I do my playlist. And when I program the show, I program three tracks back to back that are thematically related, either in the lyric or in the style of music. And then I play two sets of up-tempo and a set of ballad. That's what gives it the brightness. And within the hour, I try and touch upon all the different styles that I play.
So when listeners are either on their way out or on their way home on a weekend night, or maybe they're sitting by the fireplace during some winter weather listening with a cocktail in hand, what are you doing as host of the Fish Fry? Set the scene for me.
I have a glass of water, two turntables, two CD players. Usually I have some bad movie on in the background in the studio, and I'm trying just to stay ahead of it, you know, because once it starts, it doesn't stop. And if you make a mistake, everybody hears it. I've got a friend, a dear friend, that wants to call me up, and it's always, is this a good time to call? It's like, no, this isn't a good time to call. You know, call me when I'm not on the air, because I'm busy, you know. And I just keep it moving, try and think about what I'm going to say, how to get in and get out of it without being repetitive, how to keep the program. The challenge is keeping the program fresh. You know, you can go and play Muddy Waters. Usually there are standards that I play, like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, Professor Longhair. But there's also all these new releases coming out, so those have to be auditioned. It takes about 3 hours to put together the Fish Fry, but I never walk in without a complete playlist knowing exactly what I'm going to play.
Listening to your story, it sounds like your breakthrough moments on the way to getting your amazing job had to do with meeting people, forging relationships, and sometimes being in the right place at the right time, which may be another way of saying it's sincerity. I mean, you were in all of those places meeting all of those people because you were genuinely passionate about this stuff. I mean, you were living it before it was your job.
That's right. That's right. And also, you know, working at Penny Lane and later at the Music Exchange, you know, I was able to network with a lot of people. And it was a very high-profile job because everybody shopped at either one of those two stores, usually Penny Lane particularly. And so I was able to create a pretty good network and get my name out there. And people could, you know, knew who I was. So that helped too.
That's Chuck Haddix of KCUR's Fish Fry telling us how he got the amazing job of playing records for a living. He's part of a roundtable we've convened of Kansas Cityans with jobs that make other people, even ones with amazing jobs of their own, kind of go no fair. When we return, we'll hear from a location scout who travels the world in search of idyllic settings. Call 816-235-2888. Tell us about your incredible job and the secret to how you got it. 816-235-2888. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman. Before I hosted a radio talk show back when I was in my 20s and early 30s, my career did not take a conventional path. I worked hard. I tried a lot of things out, took odd jobs when they seemed interesting to me, service jobs, freelance gigs. I really didn't know where it was all headed. Most of the time, I was just totally comfortable with that. But sometimes I would fantasize about doing something normal just for the satisfaction of knowing that I was on a path that made sense. And then I'd meet someone with a really cool job. I mean, mind-bogglingly amazing job that I'm pretty sure they couldn't have gotten by following a conventional path. They would have gotten a conventional job by following a conventional path, and that would inspire me. Today's show is about people like that. We've met the master builder for Legoland, who builds things out of Legos for a living, and the host of KCUR's Fish Fry, whose job is to play records on Friday and Saturday nights. Now let's meet location scout Daniel Lorene. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Explain what you do for your job, what you get to do.
So basically, when they come up with an idea of where they want to shoot, what they want
Who's
it to look like. So you'll have a client who comes up with an idea, they send it off to an ad agency. The ad agency comes up with the skit or the look of what they want. And then they hire a production company. And then a production company has to put all these different people together to make this work.
Is this for commercials usually?
Commercials usually.
Okay. And then here's what you do.
Then they hire me to go out and find where they can film this at. So usually it's really specific, like, you know, we want a really large house with an open floor plan with white cabinets, black tile floor. You know, they'll get really crazy like that. And so then I've got to go out and try to find that needle in the haystack. Or they'll say, like, they always want the lone tree on a hill with the beautiful soybeans around it. So then you drive around the countryside looking for that. And they ask for winding gravel roads, overgrown trees, you know, it's whatever they're looking for, then I've got to go find.
Is this what you grew up wanting to do? I mean, did you even know that this job existed growing up?
Absolutely not. No, I was the only kid after kindergarten that still wanted to be an astronaut.
How did you pursue that? Did you pursue it?
Oh, yeah. I actually joined the Army. Was trying to work my way into helicopters. So I joined as a air traffic controller. But unfortunately, I had an accident and broke my neck. And that whole thing just kind of went away in an instant. And so I kind of moped around for a little bit. And then I picked up a camera and was taking pictures while I was recovering in the Halo traction. I was taking pictures of my nieces and other kids. And people started saying, hey, how much for that picture? So I thought as a transition, I'd go to school for photography. And I was interning with a photographer here in Kansas City. And he asked me to come in just to watch his studio one day. They were going to film a Sprint commercial there. And I was supposed to just shut off the air conditioning or answer the phones and just kind of make sure everything went okay on his side. And while I was there, I saw this guy just running around getting behind. It's a very frantic schedule every time you're shooting a commercial. And I couldn't just sit back and not do something, so I started helping this guy. And his name's Brian Mangan. He's like a brother to me. We bonded that day just over work. And he said, come work with me. You'll make twice as much and work twice as often. So I went to work with him.
Well, so you had this whole plan, I mean, that you were plotting away at back when you were, you know, going to the Army, working toward doing stuff with helicopters, the ultimate goal being astronaut. And then you have an accident that totally removes that from being something that's feasible or within reach. I mean, how did you recalibrate at that point? You said you moped around, but I mean, did you have a period of feeling really lost and without direction, even when you did have photography as something you were kind of connecting with?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a big setback for me. And it took a long time to, you know, to realize, hey, it's just like anything else in life. You just got to keep moving and rearrange. You know, you just got to play the hand the best way you can.
What you have now, like the job of going out and like, I'm going to drive through the countryside until I find the most beautiful hill with a lone tree on it. You know, like that sounds like a pretty dreamy scenario to a lot of people. I mean, it's looking for something beautiful in a beautiful place. Did it take a while for you? I mean, do you see it that way, or do you see it as kind of a runner-up to what you were originally pursuing?
Oh, I just totally don't even think about the old goal anymore. I really, really do love what I do. I love showing off Kansas City. I absolutely love when, you know, people are coming from LA or New York and they're like, what do you have that looks like this? You know, they'll ask me for something. And, yeah, I'm a true ambassador for Kansas City. I love showing it off. Pretty proud of it.
So it seems like one of the big lessons in your story is to be flexible. I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Or to do.
And that goes with this current job. You got to stay flexible because I always say, you know, if someone asks you to imagine a pink elephant, everyone's going to come up with a different pink elephant in their mind. So when you have a director or an art director from LA saying they want a super high-end white kitchen, I've learned over the years you got to ask 10 more questions, like what does that actually involve? You can't just go with your brain what you think it's going to be. So it's a lot of communication trying to, you know, eke out of them what makes up what they want.
What do you like most about what you get to do, Daniel, as a location scout?
It's a it's a genuine chance to meet lots of different people, and you get a sample of everybody else's lives. You get a sample of, you know, whatever that business is that you're going into. You know, because we want to make sure we represent that in a commercial properly. Like, you don't want to just make it up, because everyone who actually does that for a living will call you out. So you get to spend time with people, meet people, and just sample their lives. And there's a lot of great people around Kansas City.
Well, I want to bring our other panelists back in on this, because I do want us to be able to compare notes. I mean, Chuck Haddock's professional music lover and host of KCUR's Fish Fry, do you see a logic, looking back in all of the things you were doing, a logic in what you were doing all along that was leading you to exactly this amazing job you have of playing records for a living?
I think serendipity will lead you to some nice places. You know, I've been very fortunate, because, you know, not only is it you know, this course Fish Fry, but, you know, I work in a room with 360,000 records, photos, manuscripts. I collect manuscripts for the university. I do a lot of different things. I never know what every day is different for me. And, you know, I understand what Daniel's talking about. When Mr. and Mrs. Bridge came to town to do the film, they engaged me as a consultant. And it was very exciting. And also the film Kansas City by Robert Altman, I got to watch Robert Altman direct. And it can be very glamorous, but it can also be very demanding, because we all have our own perspective. I had to deal with the music director on Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, who was a very nice guy, you know. And but, you know, it is very rewarding. I remember being at a mansion over in Ward Parkway for the wrap party, and Mr. Merchant cooked Indian food for like 200 people, and they flew in El Shankar. And I was standing in the kitchen, and here comes Paul Newman up through the garage. And he's got a Budweiser. He gets a Budweiser, and he's grousing because they don't have any peanuts to go with his Budweiser.
Whoa, life is rough.
All the women, you know, all the women were just like, you know, all over Paul, and he was very gracious. Or, you know, you get backstage at Memorial Hall, and you're standing in the hallway, and all of a sudden you look, and there's David Byrne standing next to you at a Talking Head concert.
Yeah, I totally know that feeling.
What do you say to David Byrne? You don't say anything to him.
Can I get you anything?
Well, yeah. Joe, what about you? Do you think that there is a logic that led you to where you are? Is there advice to your younger self that, you know, you were following but maybe didn't realize you were following?
I don't know. I don't think there is a real logic. I think most people end up doing something they didn't set out to do. Also, I wanted to say to Daniel, if someone needed to film a commercial in space, you could, in theory, become an astronaut too, to do that.
Yeah, and you could have someone build space out of Legos.
Yeah,
we could all team up
with Chuck on the soundtrack.
Yeah, Chuck can host it.
2001: A Space Odyssey. I could see it right now. Well, it'd be 2001: A Space Oddity.
You're right.
Something that I heard Chuck, and at least in Chuck and Joe's stories, is that there were these other jobs that you guys referred to in passing, and I don't know, you know, Chuck, I think for you it was bartender, and Joe, for you it was bank teller. When you had those jobs, what was the role of those jobs in your life? I mean, conceivably, to the people around you, that is what you are. Joe, you were a bank teller.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, at least people who knew me, it was like less defining. You know, I think now that I'm the master builder at Legoland, people see me as that thing. But I think when I was a teller at a bank, it was like, oh, it's, you know, it's Joe, and that's his job that he has right now. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just, you have a job like that, people kind of brush it off. You know, it doesn't really latch onto your character as much, I think.
Chuck, what about you? Your time as a bartender? Because it feels like for you that was actually kind of instrumental. I mean, it came up because someone you met in that role, that's part of your story.
Yeah, you know, I was a bartender. I worked for and a waiter. I worked for Washington Street Station and went to work for Victoria Station. What it enabled me to do is make a lot of money. I mean, you made great money and didn't work much. I spent that's what enabled me to like go to the Beacon Cafe for lunch every day, or go to Love Records, or you know, shop the record stores, and just be free to spend my time during the day. But the other side of it is, also, you know, we party pretty hardy. You know, when you're a bartender, you sample your own wares, it enabled me to network. And actually, a lot of the friends that I have today, I met then. And we've all gone on to do very creative things. A lot of artists work down there, and a lot of writers, people that want to be writers, people that were on their way to other things. And, you know, being a bartender is a real cool thing until you hit like about, you're about, I don't know, 27 or so, and you're serving one of your high school friends, and it causes you to kind of reassess things a little bit. And I was just fortunate to run into a guy named Bob Sheldon that's in Austin right now. And he brought me into the business. You know, I mean, they would actually give me promos. And, of course, they would get a good drink out of it, too.
But it also sounds a little like doing something where you're having a good time is going to lead you to other things where you're having a good time. And I wonder if the converse is, I mean, there's a big idea out there about paying your dues to get your dream job. And it sounds a little like, I'm hearing that there might be something counterintuitive in that, like you maybe aren't going to get the dream job through misery.
Oh, no. You know, I think we have to live lives of joy. I mean, I was always a joyful thing for me. And one thing that being a bartender, you meet all kinds of different people and you become a real quick study on people. When they hit that, when they got their elbows on the bar, you learn a lot about them. But immediately you have to judge what they want and take care of them, and you know, so you learn a lot about how to deal with people.
When KCUR Central Standard returns, you have a few minutes left to ask these Kansas Cityans with amazing jobs whatever you want to know about what it means to strike employment gold and how to do it. 816-235-2888. Do it quickly. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. And today's question is, how did you get that amazing job? Our panelists answering that question are KCUR's own Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry, who plays records every weekend for a living, location scout Daniel Loreen, who travels around looking for ideal locations as part of his job, and Legoland's master builder, Joe Nunick. He builds things with Legos. Hi again, guys.
How's it going?
What do you think is the most surprising thing you've learned on your journey about success or happiness or whatever? I mean, if you saw a 20-year-old now doing what you were doing at that age, would you tell them to keep at it? Might you advise them otherwise, just given the odds?
If for anyone from my field or doing anything creatively, I would say keep making creative work, like no matter what it is. Like if you're a painter, don't feel like you have to keep making paintings, but keep doing something, because it's just you, as long as you have your hands full, you're just going to stumble into something that's a whole lot of fun. And I think you kind of figure out what you like to do as you keep making things and keep, you know, walking along, creating your own path, stuff like that. So,
Chuck?
I think that we have a tendency to hold ourselves back and to limit ourselves. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with being comfortable in your own skin. One of the things I learned from Walt Bodine when I was his engineer years ago was just to be myself.
How did he teach you that?
Just because that's the way he was. You know, I mean, he'd come in and, you know, I was doing Walt Bodine from 6 until 8 o'clock, and then I'd play these little half-hour shows, and I'd do jazz from 10 till midnight. Till 2 o'clock in the morning, rather, and they threw me in. And they didn't train me. You know, those days they just throw you in and see if you could swim. And I was afraid of the microphone, so I got to know Walt, and I really modeled my broadcasting style and a lot of my life about him, about how he was interested in people. He was kind. You know, Gina, you worked with him. You know, and just learn how to be yourself on air. I think that's the most important thing, because people can tell when you're being disingenuous.
And it sounds like off the air, too, just that being yourself is going to get you where you want to be.
And the Reverend Dwight Frizzell, I learned from him to treat everybody the same. You know, I think that's really important to connect with everybody and get out of your comfort zone a little bit.
What about you, Daniel?
I would say to my younger self, I was much more worried about trying to impress other people, like trying to be an astronaut. That was to better myself in someone else's eyes. And so obviously, you know, later in life, you realize you have much more fun. It's just everything about life is much more enjoyable when you finally come to your own, get comfortable with yourself and just start enjoying everyone around you.
I think there's a way that I have thought about that at times, which is like, do you like your days or do you just like where you think they're going? Like, if you like your days, then that is truly loving your job in a way that, you know what I mean? That is a great job.
You know, I learned a very good lesson when I became interested in broadcasting. I went back to, I've never had a broadcasting class. I've had history of broadcasting class. And Gaylord Marr, who's the curator of the Sound Archive, and one of my mentors told me, he goes, well, go talk to the chair of the department about what your dreams are about broadcasting, as Larry Ehrlich. And I went in and he said, forget it, you're never going to make it. And he made me so mad that I made it. And every time I'd see him walking across campus, I'd want to go over and slap him.
You know, so that sounds like some advice. You know? Find someone who tells you you can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. The opposite of Gaylord, who always encouraged me. You know, when I wrote my history of Kansas City Jazz, and I would take Gaylord chapters and he would edit them and he would encourage me in that effort. You know, but I still remember that. It was so discouraging. It just made me so mad. I said, I'm going to show him. I'm going to be a broadcaster.
There you go.
So, you know, I'm picking up on some pieces of advice here. Do something that you love to do something you love. Maybe get someone to light a fire under you, whether it's through encouragement or its opposite. Any other pieces of advice? I mean, I think that a lot of young people today feel like this job market is so, so scary that, and it's understandable that they have to play every step of the way, have to play it safe, or they could really end up in dire straits. I mean, even playing it safe is no guarantee. What do you think? I mean, do you think that the way that you've come into your careers still holds? Anyone?
No.
I think so. I think there's lots of opportunities out there. The main thing is you have to do what you do, find out what you really want to do, and then find out how you can get in that field and do it with joy in your heart and network with people and learn from older people in that field and get your sights on it and go for it.
Let's hear from Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Gina. I used to know you back in the Walt days, and I've known Chuck for years. I just wanted to, you too have a dream job, a very dream job, and I wanted to ask you how much Walt specifically himself affected where you are today.
Oh, man. that is a question that it would take me a while to answer. A lot. Walt affected that a lot, both on a practical level, because I have no idea under what other circumstances I would have been introduced to this kind of work. I didn't imagine myself as a live radio personality ever. I really imagined myself more behind the scenes and was hoping to get my foot in the door here was all. But meeting Walt and just, in so many ways. But I don't know even how to begin with that one. He was a really inspiring person and a really great friend, most of all, who gave a lot of advice that I still think about all the time, and like Chuck, that he was an example as much as anything else, and a great example. Anyone else have some great examples that they want to throw out there before we move on? Because it does seem like having a mentor makes a big difference.
Definitely, the film business. Somebody has to take you under their wing and show you before you make giant mistakes and you irritate somebody and they just kick you off set. So someone has to nurture you into the business, and I got lucky.
Yeah, I think a couple professors I have were definitely inspiring. It's just the way you walk around, you know, these guys are way more busier than all these students, and yet they're still probably making more work than some of the students. So it's like
making their own artwork.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I think a few of them inspired me. You know, you could walk around with a big smile on your face and be doing all kinds of things behind the scenes.
Master builder Joe Nunnick with us from Legoland. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Location scout Daniel Lorene, great meeting you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you.
And Chuck Haddix of KCUR's Fish Fry and the Mars Sound Archive. It's been fun hearing your story.
Great to be here with you, Gina.
To listen back to this conversation or anything you've heard on Central Standard, look for it at kcur.org/centralstandard later today and sign up for our podcast while you're there. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the life of Gordon Parks. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date.